Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. By any measure, the recent rhetorical exchanges between the U.S. and North Korea are enough to make you wonder what's next. Last week, the U.S. promised to station 24 long-range bombers within striking distance of North Korea. Pyongyang countered that a strike by the U.S. would result in an all-out war. The North Koreans also warned that they'll consider any buildup of U.S. troops in the region as justification to launch their own preemptive strike. The nuclear confrontation continues as well. North Korea says it's restarting its reactor and pursuing the development of nuclear warheads, and it won't even consider stopping unless the U.S. signs a non-aggression pact. Well, Washington says it won't make such a promise and won't even deal with the North Koreans until the nukes are put back on ice. On top of all this, South Koreans seem to be falling out with Washington, suggesting that they see the U.S. as more of a threat than an ally. Connection listeners, North Korea and the U.S. appear deadlocked. Is it time for Asian nations to take charge here? China, Russia, and Japan are all a lot closer to the Koreas than the U.S. Can they be any more effective in managing the current crisis? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got a couple of experts in the field of international relations involving nations in East Asia. We'll get to them in just a moment. First to Rob Gifford. Rob is NPR's China correspondent, but he's working these days in South Korea. He joins us from the capital, Seoul. Hi, Rob.
Hi there.
Sort out, if you can, the latest news for us. We've got all that war talk of last week, the South Koreans' diplomatic problems in Washington, Rumsfeld's reference to a terrorist regime, and now a North Korean newspaper saying that everyone should anticipate an attack. How is that all playing where you are?
Well, I think the most amazing thing is that it's not playing nearly as big as it might be playing in Washington. I think the South Koreans have had 50 years or more of this. They've had all the rhetoric from the North Koreans before. I think they've probably had worse. They've had the whole Cold War stretching back to the end of the Korean War in 1953. So the most amazing thing about being in Seoul is how calm everybody is. And even out on the streets, you know, There's people say, oh, yeah, we've heard this before. Even when the rhetoric is really ratcheted up as it has been over the last few days, I don't think in policy circles perhaps everyone is quite as calm. But certainly the ordinary people don't seem to be too disturbed by it.
Now, does that mean to you that the transition of power that's due to take, what, in 2 weeks' time is distracting people, that something will change when the new president takes over?
I don't think a huge amount is expected to change. The president-elect Noh Moo-hyun is from the same party as the present, the current president, Kim Dae-jung, and they are both avid supporters of this policy called the Sunshine Policy, which is basically the aim of it is to engage North Korea, to talk to them, to send delegations back and forth. And so I don't think that policy is going to change. And I think the problem is, though, that because that policy is not going to change, there's going to be problems, as you suggested in your intro, between South Korea and the United States government, because the Bush administration is hanging tough on talking tough on North Korea, doesn't want to engage with North Korea. It's very clear, although last week Richard Armitage did suggest that finally that the U.S. would talk to North Korea at some stage. The U.S. does not want to go along with this engagement policy with North Korea, which, I mean, some of the hardest liners in Washington feel basically is appeasement.
Rob, you're not easily able to get into North Korea, are you?
I'm not, actually. I have been once before. I went, I accompanied Madeleine Albright at the end of the Clinton administration, at the end of the year 2000. So I have been in there once. I think probably on the streets of North Korea, things don't change a huge amount. They probably get worse economically. And I can tell you, it's a pretty bizarre place. And there's almost no traffic on the roads. There's no industry. There's no evidence of people working, hardly, literally. And here, just 30 miles south of the DMZ, the demilitarized zone that separates the two Koreas, the city of Seoul is the complete polar opposite. I mean, the traffic is bumper to bumper. There is just neon everywhere. It is a vibrant Asian city. So really, the paradox could not be more clear.
Okay, but you've had a chance to talk to some Western correspondents who've been in Pyongyang. Are they saying that there's a real sense of tension there?
Oh, they are, yes. Just recently, two British correspondents got into Pyongyang just over the last few days, and they have been saying that there have been air raid sirens, there have been practice air raids, people being taught to rehearse how they're going to go underground into the subway systems if the U.S. is to attack. And certainly the rhetoric coming out in the newspapers, it's always strong. It's always heavily anti-American. But the last few days has really seen, there was one article, I think, yesterday in the main party newspaper that said that actually suggested that the United States was about to attack. And North Korea watchers here say that the North Korean press has never actually, in living memory, actually said so much as that.
Rob, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Rob Gifford is NPR's China correspondent. He was talking to us from Seoul, South Korea. Now, with us on the program today, Tom Christensen, professor of political science at MIT. He's a specialist in the international relations of East Asia, China's foreign relations. Han Park is also with us. He's a professor of international affairs at the University of Georgia, and he heads up the center there on the study of global issues, an expert on North Korea. He's visited there more than 30 times in the last 10 years, most recently about a year ago. And so, Han, I'll start with you, if I can. The stories that we're hearing from North Korea, the unbelievable contrast that Rob Gifford describes between what's happening in North and in South. How do you interpret this?
Well, that description is very accurate. The scene there is really resembles to a combat zone. I've been there without exception every year for the last 10, 12 years. It's not a new phenomenon, recent, but it's been like that all along. When you are there, you feel like you're in wartime and combat zone. They have evacuation drills all the time, air raid sirens all over. They have military movements that every night. So this is a very, very tense situation. And the South Korea, of course, is very different. And I might add that the South Korean government has tried to play down, because any kind of stir in terms of public opinion concerning security may affect adversely the economy tremendously. South Korean economy is based on foreign investment. So foreign investors may pull their investments out. So South Korean government has been very deliberately trying to play that scenario down.
And we should widen the lens out a little bit, Tom Christensen, and look at how the neighboring states are regarding the rhetorical battle that currently involves North Korea and the United States, but directly involves what's going to happen on the Korean Peninsula. Is China directly involved? Is Russia involved? Who are the players here?
A lot of people are involved. I think it would be wrong to call it just a rhetorical battle, in that there is a real issue at the end of the day, the nuclear developments in North Korea. So there is the rhetorical battle, but I think there's a real issue there that is actually of greater concern now to a country like China than it has ever been in the past. And I think that China is moving in the direction of being sufficiently concerned about the North Korean nuclear program to start to rethink China's policy line toward the issue. Russia has always been involved in this, and Russia has put forward some proposals, perhaps unrealistic proposals, but has been very involved in the diplomacy as well. And I think Russia sees this as an opportunity for Russia to play a great power role on the international stage in the way that Russia used to play a great power role on the international stage. And I don't think they'll be willing to forfeit that too lightly. And when I was in Beijing in January, I got the sense that there's a little bit of envy, or maybe a lot of envy in Beijing about Russia's willingness and ability to step up and play that international role, and China's frustration with its own inability to step up and do so. And there are a lot of reasons why China has been reluctant to step up and take the lead on this issue.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about those. Han Park, who do the North Koreans want to talk to? Would they sooner deal with the Chinese on this? Are they eager for some intervention from the Russians? What's your sense of that?
The answer is very simple. The North Koreans, they want the United States. Because the Korean War that erupted some 50 years ago has not ended. And we casually hear that since the end of Korean War, in fact, it never ended. In North Korea, as I portrayed, they still feel the realism of combat situation. Now, the temporary armistice agreement was signed between the United States on behalf of the United Nations and North Korea. So that war has to be concluded according to North Koreans. And tension reduction in the security area cannot be completed without the direct involvement of the United States. That's the way they feel, and I think there's some truth to that.
But do you think that the characterization that I made at the beginning of the program, that the two states, North Korea and the United States, are reaching a point where they're not really speaking to each other, is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it's a matter of face-saving at this point, and I think Washington is not uninterested in negotiating with North Korea. But they said they're going to talk, but they're not going to negotiate. And when these two adversarial parties sit down and talk, what do they talk about? They have to negotiate. So I think the window for negotiation is there. It's a matter of how we bring the two parties together without causing their losing faces. That is a challenge. And I think China and other countries can play an important role here. But I don't think these neighboring countries can do anything dramatically without involvement and participation of the United States.
And just very briefly, Tom, the timing here is becoming really key.
Yeah, the timing is key because of the reprocessing of the plutonium in the Yongbyon facility. Nobody wants to see that plutonium reprocessed into weapons-grade material, and that takes a couple of months, and it apparently has started. And the problem in a place like China, I agree with Professor Park that China could step up and set up the conditions for discussions, perhaps, if North Korea would agree to discuss things with the United States under those kind of multilateral conditions. But China has the National People's Congress coming in March, and a lot of people have waited a long time to get promoted into different positions in the foreign ministry and the defense establishment. And putting forward a controversial proposal on North Korea is not necessarily the safest way to guarantee that your expected promotion will come through.
All right, Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about North Korea, timing key, the difference between the rhetoric between Pyongyang and Washington and the reality of the nuclear development, and which nations stand to be able to assist the parties to some sort of easing off of the conflict that they talk about now. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. With me on the program today, Professor Han Park. He's at the University of Georgia, is director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues there, and author of a book called North Korea, The Politics of Unconventional Wisdom. Tom Christensen's in the studio with me. He's a professor of political science at MIT and a specialist on China and U.S. relations with East Asia. Tom, let me start with you, because China has such clout with North Korea. It's supplying, I don't know how much, half of the food that's going into North Korea now?
Yeah, that's about right, yeah.
If the Chinese said, all right, we want talks and we want them now, or we're going to cut off food or aid, they'd really be able to get the attention of Kim Jong-il.
Yeah, that would definitely get the attention of Kim Jong-il. The cut off of food, most of the food that goes into North Korea from the outside comes from China, and the vast majority of the oil that goes into North Korea from the outside comes from China, and almost all of it is from the outside. So China has what people would call leverage and could get their attention by cutting off that aid. China doesn't choose to do that for a variety of reasons. I think there is some hope or expectations even in some places in Washington that China would play that role, that would use that as a card against North Korea. But China's reluctant to do that, largely because China doesn't want to see economic chaos in North Korea. China is quite conscious of the fact that North Korea is totally dependent on China at this point.
I mean, they're already getting the refugees coming across the border.
Exactly.
They don't want hundreds of thousands more.
Exactly. Now, if you lay out China's concerns about North Korea, China does not want North Korea to have nuclear weapons. I think that's fair to say. They've worked constructively with the United States to prevent that outcome in the past. But if you look at China's fears in order of priority, what's their biggest fear? Their biggest fear is that North Korea would collapse under military pressure, in a war scenario on their border. Their second biggest fear is that there'd be instability at home in North Korea and starvation and collapse within the government and refugees going into China, et cetera. And their third fear, or their least scary scenario, is for North Korea to have nuclear weapons. And one of the problems in U.S.-China relations on the North Korea issue is that the top of the American list is that North Korea will have the ability to produce a lot of fissile material and nuclear weapons. And the main reason isn't just stability in the region. The main reason is the fear that North Korea will export fissile material and perhaps even nuclear weapons to our enemies, both state and non-state actors. And everybody knows, all your listeners will know who they are. And the real problem in U.S.-China relations is not over a difference of opinion of whether North Korea having this capability is bad or good, but just how bad is it, and what is it worth risking?
Okay, Han Park, the latest reports we're hearing from Washington seem to indicate that South Korea has the same policy, that they were saying to State Department officials, we'd sooner have a nuclear power north of us than a state in chaos. Is that an accurate reflection of the way South Korea looks at North Korea?
Yes, South Korea is very, very fearful of the possibility of North Korean system collapse. And it's been like that. That kind of fear has been with South Korean regimes for a long time, and especially when we have a new government with new leadership, Roh Moo-hyun. I think that fear will be even greater. And I would have to agree with Professor Christensen in that the China can play some role because it has a lot of leverage. Perhaps no other country has as much leverage as China does. But both China and South Korea know better in that North Korea is not going to be giving in realistically to the pressures by way of economic aid, economic sanction, humanitarian aid sanction. It has to, their fear of national security would have to be dealt with as a security issue. And I think the Chinese and South Koreans know that with economic and humanitarian aid sanctions, we cannot bring about North Korea free of these weapons.
You mentioned a little bit earlier, though, that South Korea operates with its economic priorities at a very high level, but it also seems as if South Korea is willing to sacrifice some of its historical good relations with the United States in order to keep the peace with the North.
And I think it's not really sacrifice, and I think it's not a zero-sum game. South Korea can establish or maintain a very rosy relations with the United States without risking a conflict there on the peninsula. And I think this is a transitional period where new government in Seoul is going to come in, and we really don't know what kind of policy specifically with respect to North Korean nuclear preparedness Moon Jae-in government will pursue. And when things get a little settled, then I think there will be a way of finding a win-win situation for all parties concerned.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Let's go to Independence, Wisconsin. Dwayne's on the line. Hi, Dwayne.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Pardon?
I said thanks for calling.
Well, no, I'm just fascinated with your program and some of the things that I'm hearing.
Dwayne, can you reach over and turn your radio down? We're hearing
a bit
of an echo from you.
No problem.
Thanks a lot.
No problem. Okay.
I gather you're just back from the region.
Yes, I just came back from a week in Taiwan and a week in South Korea. Came back last Friday.
And what have you got to report?
Well, I would suggest that several of the comments that were made are right on target, but I'm a little bit concerned about one thing, and I think it's the political and economic goals of South Korea are quite different than ours at the moment. And they're saying to me now, the people that I met, common ordinary people, let us alone, we'll figure out the problem. The United States is an ink drop.
Do you think that goes so far, Dwayne, as to talk? Are the South Koreans talking about the possible reunification of the Korean Peninsula, removal of U.S. troops there?
They don't go so far as removal of the U.S. troops. But the reunification is the number one priority, as I saw it, in South Korea, including when I went to the war memorial. I spent 2.5 hours in the war memorial, and the little tape that they have that shows the Korean War, the whole thing is almost like a propaganda thing, encouraging people to think about reunification. I think it's the number one priority of South Korea, but I'm not so sure that it's the number one priority of us.
Han Park, what would look at the talk of reunification? Do you think it's something that's realistic in the South?
I don't think there's any question it'll happen.
Dwayne, let me turn to Han Park on that one if I can. Just hang on a sec, Professor Park.
Yes, I think the unification is still as a matter of emotional issue. When it comes down to the cost of reunification, South Koreans, as well as North Koreans, especially South Koreans, they will be very careful in approaching toward unification. The cost of unification, not in terms of limited to economic, but also social, political. Unprepared, hasty unification would mean social chaos, and there will be all kinds of disruptions, including assassinations and so forth. So South Koreans are very, very functionally realistic, and I don't think unification will be approached with concrete policies anytime very soon.
And Tom Christensen, what would the Chinese or the Japanese think about a reunified Korea?
China's not so much opposed to a unified peninsula in principle, but they certainly don't want it to happen quickly. And I don't just mean they don't want it to happen quickly because they don't want it to happen through violence or collapse, but because they like the idea that the peninsula is divided. What they would like to see is a reform process in North Korea similar to what China has gone through, a very gradual economic reform process which North Korea opened up to the outside world, became a more normal integrated economy, and then could address the issue of how to deal with South Korea. And this would give China time to have a buffer. It would give China time to deal with the implications of a united Korea and its diplomacy. And it would give China more time to gain additional leverage in the Korean Peninsula. And that leverage is growing quickly, not with the North so much, but with the South. Mm-hmm. The Chinese economy is now surpassing Japan as the most important economy in South Korea. And this is something that's become very apparent to an increasingly sophisticated Chinese foreign ministry that their economic leverage in the region is a real source of diplomatic power. And it takes time for China to develop that aspect of its national greatness.
And Duane, when you were talking with South Koreans on the street, were they saying to you that they don't like the way that they're being regarded by America these days? What?
No, I don't think there's, no. It's not a question of how they're being regarded as, you know, by Americans. It's more of an open criticism, including all their newspapers, of our foreign policy. I mean, it's a whole different issue.
Foreign policy with specific reference to North Korea, or are you talking about general Iraq and the war on terror?
Our total foreign policy situation is, in fact, I have newspapers I brought back with me, and the editorials in the newspaper and the political cartoons are pretty negative, not of America, but of American governmental foreign policy things.
All right, Duane, I just want to take one aspect of that and ask Han Park to speak to it, and that is a reflection from you, Professor, on how it is that Washington's policy is being seen in North Korea, because we read Western interpretations of it saying, gosh, you got State Department saying we're willing to talk. You got Rumsfeld talking about North Korea as a terrorist regime. Is it a confused message that Washington's sending?
I don't think North Koreans are confused. They're getting a very hawkish and very determined message coming out of the Bush administration. North Koreans have no misgivings about, and they are very realistic. And to make the public more concerned about, fearful of possible United States attack would be conducive to their solidifying their power base and political integration. So they're not interpreting Washington signals as being confusing.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Raleigh, North Carolina, Greg's on the phone. Hi, Greg.
Hello, good morning, and 안녕하세요, gentlemen.
안녕하세요.
Go ahead, Greg.
Well, I had a comment. I think, Duane, your previous caller was right on about how North Koreans in general perceive American and American foreign policy. I've been over there a couple times. I'm heading back in about a month. And I'm really kind of worried about the situation over there because last year, when the axis of evil was still new and, the comments hadn't really sank in and the government wasn't talking about going into Iraq as much, there didn't seem to be a real problem with North Korea. The South Koreans that I know, that no gentleman in North Korea generally thought, like, okay, if you're in North Korea, there were 37,000 enemy troops right to the border to the south of you. And all of a sudden, out of perceivably nowhere, the American government comes up and says, oh, you're part of the Axis of Evil. And that would make anybody really nervous in that situation because they don't really have anyone else to rely on other than China. So I can understand why the North Koreans started up their nuclear program again, as well as why they want a treaty in order to stop it. I don't really think that we're giving them many options right now. And I think that's really the cause of the problem at this point.
Han Park, is it a defensive move that the North Koreans see themselves being involved in, restarting their nuclear program?
And I think I have no doubt that they have been trying to manufacture nuclear weapons all along. And I think the caller has a very good observation. For us to believe North Korea will disarm, even if North Korea did say they're going to disarm and discontinue weapons program, to believe that they actually will do is utterly naive. Unless we change the climate there, as the caller suggested, North Koreans develop intense sense of fear. They have no one to turn to. So in this kind of situation, there's no way that we can induce North Korea to comply with all these measures of IAEA and NPT.
Tom?
Yeah, there's a huge problem here, though, that if you look at the American force deployments in South Korea, for example, there's really no danger that those 37,000 forces could be used for an invasion of North Korea. The North Korean forces near the 38th parallel are quite formidable. They have somewhere in the thousands of artillery shells pointed at Seoul, and Seoul is unfortunately located very close to the DMZ. There's really no danger of a kind of ground invasion out of the blue. Where there is a danger, and I actually think it's a good thing that North Korea is worried about this danger, is there is a danger that the United States will not tolerate the Yongbyon facility being used to reprocess plutonium into weapons-grade fissile material. And I wish that the South Koreans were more concerned about that. I wish that the Chinese were more concerned about that. Because whereas all the goals are the same in the region, in South Korea, in Beijing, and even in the United States, about the North Korean nuclear program, nobody likes it. Right? Washington is very, very concerned about this program for reasons that are related to American national security, the fear that an atomic weapon will one day be detonated in San Francisco or New York City or Chicago. And this is somewhat unique in America's relationship in the region. The US-ROK alliance certainly served America's national security interests, but it was very clearly about protecting South Korea from an attack since the Korean War and during the Korean War. The problem is now the United States is saying, here is a national security risk to us. It may not be nearly as much of a national security risk to you if North Korea, to you, South Korea, if North Korea exports these materials. South Korea is extremely unlikely to be the target.
Han Park, let me hear you on that.
Right. I think South Koreans do not feel the North Koreans having essentially possessing nuclear bombs as a great danger to South Korea, because as Professor Christian suggested, North Korea is not expected to use the weapons against the South.
Right.
And I think here's the important matter here is North Korea is changing. And I think Kim Jong-il is misportrayed largely. He is very pragmatic, very shrewd person. When we saw Kim Jong-il inviting Koizumi from Japan and apologizing and admitting that they, in fact, kidnapped and apologized. And he was trying to redeem himself and trying to make himself a formidable and legitimate player in the international community. We're not giving him that opportunity. So I think it's so important to allow North Korea to get out of that, and engagement policy should be restored here.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, the call from North Korea is for the U.S. to sit down at the table and talk and negotiate. So far, Washington seems reluctant or unwilling to do that given the conditions. Your thoughts, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And with me on the program today, Han Park, Professor of International Affairs and Director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia, author of North Korea, The Politics of Unconventional Wisdom. Tom Christensen's here. He's a specialist on China-U.S. relations with East Asia, Professor of Political Science at MIT. We should talk probably briefly, Tom, I'll get you to start, about a meeting that's taking place tomorrow. The International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna is holding an emergency session to look at what's going on at the Yongbyon reactor, perhaps even to declare North Korea in breach of its commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Can that agency say anything or do anything which will have any resonance? I mean, America's saying don't do it. What difference will it make if the IAEA says it?
Well, the IAEA can refer this to the United Nations Security Council, and that will be a big event in this drama. The United Nations Security Council can, in fact, call for sanctions against North Korea for violations of its international agreements on this score, and it will put a country like China in a very tough position. whereas China doesn't want to unilaterally threaten sanctions against North Korea in a way that some in Washington would prefer, China really cares greatly about a few things, particularly in the last year or two. It cares greatly about its role in the United Nations Security Council, and it doesn't just want to step aside every time an important issue comes up. It cares greatly about its reputation as a cooperative great power on the issue of nonproliferation. It has not been a cooperative power on the issue of nonproliferation traditionally, and it has tried to change its domestic laws, et cetera, to send out an image of China as a responsible power on this issue. So it puts China in a more difficult position. That is where, in a sort of indirect way, China's aid to North Korea may provide it some leverage. I did want to say something about the plutonium and why the IAEA is so concerned about the plutonium. If you look back at the history, the last caller was correct probably about North Korea's concern about the Bush administration. But if you look back at the history, North Korea violated its agreements, the agreed framework, the NPT, and its agreement with the South on a nuclear-free peninsula. Mm-hmm. In the late 1990s, long before the Bush administration was in office. And it did that by pursuing highly enriched uranium. Highly enriched uranium is a relatively inefficient way to make nuclear weapons. It takes a long time. It's not a very difficult way, but it takes a long time to do. Plutonium and reprocessing of plutonium in up-and-running plants is not very difficult once you've made all the hurdles, and North Korea has done that. Yongbyon is dangerous because North Korea can produce a lot of fissile material and a lot of weapons-grade material in a hurry. And so, that's why it's so urgent, and that's what's different about what's happening now than what has happened in the past. And I'm actually somewhat concerned when regional actors are relatively relaxed about the situation and saying this is more of the same. It is not more of the same, and it is an issue over which the Clinton administration in 1994 threatened war. And I think the threat of war is there again. And I think regional actors and Americans need to take that extremely seriously.
Professor Park, the meeting of the IAEA, will this be an event of note for the North Koreans? Does it change the balance?
And I doubt that. And I certainly expected that the IAEA and the United Nations may take the Security Council and they may decide on applying sanctions, but let me say this. Sanctions will not work. North Korea has been under severe sanctions for decades now. You cannot sanction to a country that doesn't have any reliance on outside. China may have some leverage, but I agree with the professor that China is not going to sanction just because the United Nations or United States wanted it to do, because China knows sanctions will produce a very little effect as far as what we want, and that is nuclear-free Korea. And I think, and also from the United States point of view, options are very limited. You know, no action is not acceptable because weeks and months ahead, North Korea will have many more nuclear bombs. And striking North Korea, even surgical strike, is not acceptable because it would certainly incur millions of people's lives.
But are you also agreeing with Tom Christensen that things are particularly dangerous now, given the pace that North Korea could use to create more plutonium? Is it plutonium? Or
it's weapons-grade plutonium. They have to reprocess it to make it into weapons-grade fissile material.
Yes, inaction certainly would mean that. So we really cannot sit and wait. So we've got to negotiate. We've got to talk to them. And, wasting time is really lost time.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Hampton Roads, Virginia. Charles is joining us now. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, Dr. Yeah. Park. Annyeonghaseyo.
Yes, annyeonghaseyo.
I was your student at the University of Georgia.
Oh, really?
Yes, back in 1980.
All right.
What have you been doing since then, Charles?
I'm a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army. I've been in for 22 years now, and I just recently completed a tour working at the Combined Forces Command Headquarters in Seoul at the Yongsan base.
That's great.
But my question...
I hope I taught you right.
Pardon me?
It's okay. I thought you were right.
You did. In fact, that's why I called. I remember as a student, you made the point that went to us that we often tried to Westerners often tried to use the game of chess as sort of a template for foreign policy, and that in order to understand Asian international politics, that we ought to consider the game of Go. And I was wondering if that's maybe part of our difficulty, that we don't have the right templates with which to examine the political and social structures that are coming into play.
Professor Park?
Yes, I think we are too much in the West elitist-oriented. We think North Korean issue can be alleviated completely and once and for all if we handle Kim Jong-il right. Kim Jong-il is also under severe pressure and perhaps influenced by different sectors in the society, the party, the military, the mass people, and intellectuals. So no society can be effectively dealt with. We only look at the top, just like, you know, chess game. The Go game is really dealing with the grassroots, and I think American foreign policy needs to pay attention to the grassroots people as well.
Professor Christensen?
Yeah, I wanted to say something about a potential solution to this. And when we talk about the Chinese role in particular, there's a very good role that China can play. And one of the interesting things about this conflict is that if you go to Beijing and you go to Seoul and you go to Washington, everybody basically agrees in what they see the future, what they believe the future should look like. And rather than China playing a role of threatening North Korea and trying to get it to back down, which I agree with Professor Park, they're unlikely to do, and I'm not certain will work in any case. What China can do is lay out a vision for the region. In other words, just say, we're going to have a meeting. The United States will be there, North Korea will be there, maybe some other countries will be there, maybe Russia.
This won't happen before the All People's Congress in March, though, will
it? The National People's... I'm not certain. I think it will depend, whether China's willing to play this role will depend largely on how seriously they view the threat that the United States will take out that facility. And I don't think we can underestimate the danger of that, that the United States will just say, this is intolerable, we have to take out that facility. And if they believe that there's a danger that that will occur, it may increase their momentum in the direction of playing the constructive role that I'm laying out. But just if I could have a moment just to lay out what that role would be to say, here's how we envision the future security environment in this region. We envision not just a shutdown of the current activities in North Korea, but the total dismantling of the Yongbyon facility and the removal of those plutonium rods from the country, so that in 2 years we don't have to play this drama again. We also envision the United States having some sort of diplomatic contacts and relations with the North. We envision economic interaction with the North in Japan and the United States, the lifting of some of the punitive measures that various countries have put on North Korea over the years. And we envision a kind of Deng Xiaoping-style gradual reform process in the North. And they could lay that out as a vision, rather than as a negotiating process. And the thing is that Washington is not against any of those outcomes on the far end, as long as Washington is not forced to concede all of those things under the conditions in which North Korea has clearly unilaterally violated previous agreements, because that looks like blackmail. And I have to say, as an outside observer, it looks like blackmail to me, too.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Han Park, you began the program by saying that the North Koreans really only want to deal with Washington, but what Tom Christensen's saying is that the regional players are the ones who can facilitate that, who can make that work. Will Kim Jong-il accept a vision from China that leads to some cooling off in relations?
And I think the regional governments can play facilitating roles, but certainly they cannot make it happen. The United States along the line must be involved. And I think the optimal solution is very close to what Professor Christian suggested, and that is collective security concept. In this collective security, you should include the United States as well as North and South Korea and China, Japan, probably Russia. And then their more comprehensive, much more blown up version and extended version of the KEDO, Korea Energy Development Organization. Now we have a comprehensive, which should include the security measures as well as economic incentives. Then North Korea, As long as the United States is a party to this consortium of countries, North Korea will be, in my opinion, amenable to that arrangement. I think China can lead this campaign, and probably China can be the leader of this thing. Although the United States eventually would have to step up its effort.
Yeah, I just make a small point on that the United States needs to be involved. The problem now is that North Korea is demanding that there be negotiations rather than dialogue, and B, that they be bilateral. And it's one of the strange things about the Bush administration. It's always criticized for being unilateral and treating everything bilaterally. It wants someone else to step up on this one, and it wants a multilateral solution, and North Korea doesn't want it. And many people have criticized the Bush administration for not going unilateral. And I agree with Professor Park that in this instance, the real solution is a consortium, and I think it's something that everybody in the region can live with. And that's the frustrating thing about this entire crisis, is that everybody seems to be on the same page with the possible exception of Kim Jong-il, and that's what nobody seems to know.
But at some point, Han Park, all the parties need to address this in a way where they don't lose face. I mean, you have Donald Rumsfeld banging his fist and talking about a terrorist regime. You have the workers' newspaper in Pyongyang saying it could be war. Somebody's got to turn this around.
You know, the face saving is all North Koreans have. In fact, they don't have anything else. It's very important for the United States, the only superpower, and we need to have face saving measures as well. And I think the art of negotiated settlement must be understood. Everyone has to give in something, somewhat. No one gets its own way all the way. So North Koreans would have to give in. As long as, say, this consortium situation, there will be an occasion where North Koreans and Americans can sit down together under the umbrella of consortium, which is just fine. They get what they want without losing the face. So here I think that the most ingenious idea would be still the creation of consortium and initiated by Japan, China, and South Korea.
Well, we'll watch for that. I want to thank both of you for being with us on the program. Han Park, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Professor Park is from the University of Georgia and director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues there. Tom Christensen, thanks for being in.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Christensen teaches political science at MIT. And earlier in the program, we talked with Rob Gifford, NPR's China correspondent. He's currently based in Seoul. Connection listeners, we invite you to continue the conversation in our online forums. We're at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. We had help today from Kim Bichari, Dara Manoogian, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our interns are Dania Akkad and Kevin Sangudi. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.